My name is Eric, and I welcome you to our Black Gay Diaspora podcast, where we, as LGBTQ plus citizens, come together to inspire and educate each other on who we are in our respective countries and professions. Through topics and guest interviews, our Black Gay Diaspora podcast celebrates individuals making a difference. Loving who we love is not a choice. Being who we're meant to be can be. We are here. You are welcome. We are community. I have been fortunate to converse twice in person with this episode's esteemed guest, Phineas Newborn III. The first was over lunch in New York City, and the second time was in Los Angeles, California. Phineas met up with me in Santa Monica, and I was his travel companion in LA's late afternoon rush hour traffic. Now I have to concede to us speaking virtually for this conversation. The son of American jazz pianist Phineas Newborn Jr., Phineas III is an accomplished actor, dancer, choreographer, and producer with a show business career spanning over 25 years. His performance credits include the 1984 breakdancing themed film Breaking and the musicals Cats, Ragtime, and Aida on Broadway. Other credits include the films Girls Just Want to Have Fun and the television series Fame. As a dance instructor, Phineas has taught in Germany, France, England, Sweden, Japan, New Zealand, and Canada, as well as with top schools in Los Angeles and New York. Some of his students have worked with such notables as Michael Jackson, Janet Jackson, Prince, and Britney Spears. Phineas himself has choreographed and or performed with Gladys Knight, James Brown, Prince, Jasmine Guy, Paula Abdul, Kathleen Turner, Danny DeVito, Seal, Lenny Kravitz, just to name a few. I feel I'm only touching a fraction of what Phineas has accomplished in his career so far. In addition to his professional credentials, what stands out to me is the serenity and peace that one feels when interacting with Phineas. He has a light that is fueled by his intellect, wisdom, and his life experiences. Hey, Phineas, and welcome. How are you?
Good. I'm very good. I'm excited to share and talk with you.
Before I get going in this conversation, I just first of all want to thank Gamal G. Tarawar, or G as he's known by, for connecting us. Thank you, G.
Thank you, G.
Yeah, and I'll try not to rub it in because he has been saying that he's envious that I have met you twice and he's yet to meet you in person.
We have a fond connection, but it's always been via the internet. And that's unfortunate, but hopefully we'll resolve that shortly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I look forward to hearing about when you guys meet up in person. I was actually surprised because separately and together, because I did a virtual call with you guys, I think it was right before the holidays, Christmas, and just your interaction between the two of you, it's like you guys, I just was like, you almost grew up together.
Yeah, no, it feels like we're definitely kindred spirits. That's for sure. I mean, I had no idea, and you have no idea when you are in the entertainment industry whose lives you're going to touch that you don't know personally. But he was just one of those people who really just amazed me at the part that I played in his story without realizing it. I think very fondly of G, and I'm just so grateful that he actually connected us together.
When we last talked, the three of us, you were, I think right before you were heading to Asia for a tour with your husband, Boone. How was
yes.
that?
It was really, really, really wonderful. I was a little apprehensive at first because, again, I was leaving for 6 weeks. And to be gone from home and my routine was a little daunting. But what ended up happening was just an amazing journey that unfolded organically that was just truly wonderful. I mean, it's always great to see him in his element because he's Chinese Malaysian.
Okay.
And to hear him speak his native language in Mandarin and to actually communicate with an audience and people that he's ministering to is just truly inspiring. We had some amazing time actually where he wasn't ministering. And we had a chance to visit Bali, which was amazing, the most beautiful place I've ever been to in my life. And just had some really wonderful experiences meeting friends and community and LGBT community, especially in Asia, which he's very involved in reaching out to and supporting.
I remember when we first connected, you had mentioned his career as a minister. And I think it was an article that I read, or maybe it was you that said he's like the Martin Luther King in Asia for the LGBTQ plus community.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it feels like that because there is that danger also when I accompany him in terms of him highlighting a lot of his work in terms of the LGBT community. But yeah, I mean, in terms of his voice and his energy and his passion and his charisma, it's definitely on the line of that kind of a leader, because he's definitely willing to definitely step in to shoes that, regardless of danger, regardless of pushback, he's willing to stand and, you know, and support us, which is extremely important, especially for the Asian community, because as the Black community has its own challenges, the Asian community has another set of its own that makes it very difficult for them to feel comfortable coming out because of family pressures and just their culture. So it's just really wonderful to just hear him be an advocate, really supporting and inspiring and motivating people to really pursue their true lives and to actually find happiness, and us being able to actually give an example of what a healthy, loving relationship can look like long term.
This is, of course, about you, this interview, but if we could just stay on him for a moment longer. How did you two meet?
We actually met online. It was actually kind of an interesting situation because at the time I had come out of a marriage for 16 years with a female, and I had not really ever been single in my adult life. So this was the first time that I was single, and I was really not looking for a relationship. But my daily mantra for myself was, I am becoming who it is I want to attract. And that was a very important mantra for me to say out loud and also write down, but to also just wake up with in terms of just dating at that point in my life, because I was in my early 40s. I used my mantra as an opportunity for me to see if I was on track to becoming who it was that I was attracting. So when I first met Boone, I was interested because I was like, wow, this is a very interesting person. But it wasn't until I actually sat down and had more of an in-depth conversation with him about his background that I realized that he was hitting all of the notes on my list of qualities I needed. But I was still not fully just committed to entering a relationship until my former wife, who is also a very close friend of mine, said to me, Phineas, I think you really need to consider looking at Boone a lot more seriously than you have been. I think he's possibly one of the good ones. So I took her advice. I mean, again, when you meet somebody and they tell you that they're a Christian minister, the first thing that goes up is, how is that possible? And then the second thing was that he was a published author. And at that point, had written like 35 books that had been published in Mandarin.
Wow.
And he was also a professor in higher education and was working on his dissertation to become a doctorate in theology. So I was like, okay, you don't meet these kinds of people too often. The situation for me was just that he was going to be somebody that I wanted to be in my life for a long time. He moved in after 6 months, and I proposed to him 2 years later. He got his dissertation. When I proposed to him was actually the day that it became legal in New York City to actually have marriage equality. When he came into my life, I had no idea in terms of how he would impact my life on so many levels, and that I would be spending so much time in Southeast Asia being a part of an LGBT movement that is just really amazing to witness and to watch grow.
It sounds healthy all the way around on your end, on his end, you having a supportive network to help you to see that he was somebody that is a positive in your life.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I don't want to minimize the role that my former wife, Karine, played in it, because she has always been confidant and friend first and foremost. And when she gives me her opinion, I definitely listen. Her intuition and her instincts have always proven to be really good. So I did not question it. I think one of the biggest things for me when it comes to relationships was finding somebody who could love me the way I loved myself. But I have to love myself the way I want to be loved. For example, that meant I was going to cook food for myself because I loved myself enough to cook a good meal for myself. I was going to go to the movies by myself if I was going to go to a movie. One of my favorite sayings is that, you know, God's sorting process is closing doors, is saying no. That's not just rejection. That is God intervening. Another thing that I learned in my career as an artist, auditioning, it was not meant to be. And that came in terms of relationships too. So I realized that if somebody was not really into me and I was more into them, that was okay because that was God sorting.
I have to admit, I was a little nervous during the intro. And again, we've met a couple times in person, but I guess because I'm trying to be, or I am in professional mode, I want to make sure at the same time that, yeah, I just had to say that.
I totally understand, especially nerves as a performer was something that you had to totally make friends with because it gives you a boost in adrenaline. So it actually allows the performance to oftentimes be much better than it would be if you were not nervous.
Yeah.
I taught for many, many years. And of course, dealing with teaching, you're dealing with students that are oftentimes nervous. Either we're getting ready to perform and they're nervous, or they're nervous because of just being isolated and being asked to do something by themselves. I would always say to my students, you know what? The magic happens in the unknown. And the unknown is what you're most nervous about.
After we were connected through Jir and before we had spoken, when I started to do my own initial dive into who you are, I found your YouTube channel and I was like, I feel like I should be sending you money because these are amazing.
It's very interesting because I did those a while ago and I haven't really been pursuing that as much as I was at that time. But when I look back on them, I see the growth in them, I see the changes in them, and I see obviously what I would do differently now versus then. Because I actually just shared with a friend of mine who was in Taiwan. He said a similar thing. He was like, these are amazing. You should really be doing this. I would pay you lots of money for a workshop. My original intention behind doing them was to actually move more into motivational speaking, allow myself to actually have a platform and a voice that could be easily accessed. Because I know that when I was going through a lot of my roughest times in my experience, in my physical experience, one of the only things that I could actually rely on to keep my energy out of being depressed or sad or worried were YouTube videos, affirming YouTube videos, positive message YouTube videos, because of the support and comfort that they brought to me. It's one of the things that really saved my life when it comes to just giving me and allowing me to actually reclaim my physical health and my mental health and my spiritual health. Was through YouTube videos.
Yeah, that was one of the things that stood out to me too, is your candor in sharing about some of the things that were going on with you, with health and other things. You've kind of referenced that in this conversation so far, is like when we are being vulnerable, that's where we find our strength.
Yes, no, absolutely. For the majority of my career, I was telling other people's stories and being paid to tell other people's stories. It wasn't until I actually had my own personal story to share that I realized this is really where my power lies. I mean, obviously, I enjoyed and I became very good at telling other people's stories through dance, through singing, through words. But it wasn't until I connected with my own story and felt like I could actually share it authentically that allowed me to realize that this is really where my voice is that can touch people. I mean, I knew as a teacher, as a dance teacher, or even as an acting teacher, that I had a gift in terms of being able to communicate important information in terms of improving somebody's performance, teaching somebody how to find their balance so they can do pirouettes or how to jump off the ground and do a jeté and how to make it look good. But it wasn't until I actually realized that sharing my own story and my own experience was just tremendous. I think probably where I really started learning that mostly was when I was leading a support group for people with chronic illness. I know what you're going through, and this is what I learned.
Is it okay if we talk about what you went through?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so I was doing AIDA at the time. In 1999, I started doing AIDA. In 2000, we opened on Broadway. I had been given a book from a student of mine called The Alchemist. I was writing a musical adaptation of that and doing the show. I also started feeling like I was getting certain illness symptoms. And I thought that it was just because I was living in a new place like New York and maybe there were different allergies. And I went to see a family practitioner because I knew I needed to find a new practitioner for my wife and my daughter at the time. And he said, okay, well, let's do all the tests. He said, have you ever done an HIV test? And I says, no, because when I was married, my former wife had to take one because she was French and hers came back negative. So I just assumed that I was going to always be negative. And he says, well, let's just throw one in just to make sure. Well, when he got the results back and called me into the office to share those results with me, I was devastated. I was not HIV positive. I was in full-blown AIDS. I was doing an 8-show week at the time and had no idea that I had been carrying this virus inside of me. So of course, first, my biggest concern was to my former wife because I was like, okay, well, if I have it, let's pray and hope that I did not pass it on to her, because if I passed it on to her, then I would have also passed it on to my daughter. My former wife was also doing the show with me at the time, which is also amazing. But when I got my diagnosis, we didn't know about her diagnosis for 2 weeks. So we were doing the show for 2 weeks, not knowing whether she was infected or not. And that was probably the hardest 2 weeks of my life. The end of the first act is a song called The Gods of Nubia. It's a very emotional song. We would literally, after the song, be on stage hugging and sobbing for the entire intermission, not knowing what the future was going to hold. So basically what ended up happening was that after being diagnosed, I was told that if I didn't take the cocktail, which I, being very stubborn, chose to not take the cocktail, he said, well, if you don't take this cocktail, the HIV cocktail of different drugs that help basically reduce your numbers down to zero. When I was first diagnosed, I had 26 T cells and my viral load was in the millions. I had a lot of virus in my system and had no immune system to basically battle it. I didn't take the cocktail. I tried some other alternative means and ended up getting pneumonia. And I was actually in the hospital with pneumonia on 9/11. I went into the hospital on 9/10. I woke up in the morning of 9/11. My sister called me. She says, "Finish turning the TV. There's a plane that flew into the World Trade Center." I turned on the TV just in time to watch the second plane fly into the World Trade Center. And at that point, Eric, I thought, you know what? The world is over. So I don't really have to worry about my personal crisis. This is all ending for everybody. But that was basically my entrance into my first health crisis, was pneumonia. I was out of the show for 3 weeks and went back into the show after that 3 weeks and still chose, being very stubborn, to not take the cocktail. And my doctor at the time told me, he says, well, Phineas, if you don't take this cocktail, you're probably going to get a worse opportunist infection than pneumonia, and you may not survive it. 6 months later, I got meningitis and was in the hospital for a year. I went to the hospital in December 2002 and came out November 2003. My body could not fight the meningitis and the HIV at the same time and the AIDS at the same time. They had told my former wife and my family that I was going to die on 3 different occasions. They told the cast from AIDA to come and say their last goodbyes. I was not supposed to leave the hospital. What ended up happening was after 3 months of being in the hospital and still being stubborn and not taking a cocktail, the doctor came in and says, you know what, Phineas, you really don't have another choice. Your meningitis has moved into hydrocephalus, which means that basically you're not going to have a brain that you even want to even use if you survive. And I says, okay, well, let's try the cocktail. And he says, well, there's no guarantee that it will work because you've waited so long, but we'll try. And fortunately, Eric, it worked. And I was able to actually overcome the meningitis. I had a shunt put in my head. They gave me high dosages of steroids. So about a year after me coming out of the hospital, I ended up having to have bilateral hip replacements. Because of the high dosages of steroids that I was given, the blood stopped going to my bones. And so basically, during that whole experience, Eric, that was when I really realized a lot of spiritual revelations. in terms of who I was and what I identified myself with. I, at that point, had identified myself with my accomplishments and everything that I was able to achieve, from being in movies to being on TV to being on Broadway. That's who I was. I was a teacher. I was a husband. I was a performer. In a split second, it was all taken away. And I realized I had to really look at who I really was. And I realized in that moment that I was not my body, that I was so much more than my physical experience. That was the beginning of my journey into establishing a deeper spirituality regarding my experience and my connection to this physical experience. Because I realized that everything physical is temporary. And that's one of the things that I constantly remind myself daily. We get so attracted and attached to holding on to physical possessions, our bank accounts, our money. They become our identity. I often say to people, I said, you know, we live in this false sense of security because we think that we're going to wake up tomorrow. So we live our lives in a way that just is, takes it for granted. And when my former wife asked me for the divorce, that was like the last straw. That was the last part of who I thought I was, the last stroke on the canvas that I created. And I was just like angry and I hated her for it. So I was holding on to a part of myself that was really not who I really was. But I was not at the point in my spiritual journey to really understand that then.
One word that stands out is warrior. You survived something, several things that were traumatic emotionally and physically. I have to concede I'm more spiritual than religious, but I've heard that phrase spiritual warrior, and I would definitely apply that to you.
Well, thank you. No, I appreciate that. I think that there are certain parts of my spirit that have always been there, but it wasn't until I actually was forced to actually engage with that spirit. I'm talking about actively speaking to, engaging with my spiritual energy. Embracing Christianity is my main core belief system. It changed a lot when I started really recognizing scripture through my husband's ministry, because he's very, very liberal when it comes to spiritual interpretation or scripture interpretation. What's mythological and what's factual. That really kind of opened my mind up even more to the ideas of just religious spirituality. I don't consider myself to be really religious. I consider myself to be spiritual. Even his ministry, which has kind of changed over the last, now we've been together for 15 years, he's changed a lot in the last 15 years, where he's become more of an interfaith ministry as opposed to just a Christian ministry, where he incorporates Buddhist traditions and Islamic traditions and just other positive belief systems and other spiritual religions that can be incorporated into our daily lives to allow us to actually evolve and to be greater human beings.
Have you thought about writing a book, or I mean, around your life in general, but the specific period of your life? And I definitely could see it as a movie, not just with you, but also just you sharing your former wife and the fact that you guys are just still have this amazing connection. Yeah.
I have thought about writing a book. I actually even have a title for it. Dying to Be Newborn is the name of my book. There's so many aspects of my life that I think people would relate to and find interesting, whether it's my sexuality or my family history, growing up as the son of a famous jazz pianist and finding their own way through that. Also, my dad's story is also huge and it's tremendous, and it's actually inspired movies. Mo Better Blues, there is a scene in Mo Better Blues that Spike Lee actually told me was inspired by my dad. So his story, my story, the different aspects of my life in terms of my career, my sexuality, fluid sexuality, I would say, in terms of at a certain point in my life. I first came out as a gay man, though, when I was 19. I had my first boyfriend from 19 to 24, and then moved to Europe and wanted to have an experience with a female. that was, again, something I needed to do for myself, because I thought in that point in time in my youth that I was going to learn something different from being in a relationship with a female than I had been with a male. This was something interesting. A question came up to me during this last trip, and I thought, let me remember this because I want to actually refer to this in this podcast. I was in Malaysia or China. No, I was in Taiwan. And a person asked me, she said, what's the difference between being in a heterosexual relationship and being in a homosexual relationship? What did you find that was the difference? And I said, the biggest difference for me was that the heterosexual experience taught me how to love. Women are more available and able to express their emotions, not to the point of just expressing them, but giving you reasons and when, why things are happening. And my relationship with Karine was extremely loving. We met in Paris. She was my dance student. She became my artistic muse. And the way I even explain it to my daughter is I say, I loved your mom like I never loved another woman, and I'll never love another woman the way I loved your mom. That is, in a nutshell, how I view my experience with Karine, is that I loved her deeply. And the beauty that she taught me wasn't just when we were together, but it was her unconditional love when we were actually apart. Because when I was in the midst of my deepest, harshest anger towards her, she never stopped loving me. And I didn't understand it until actually reflecting on it later, that she was teaching me how to love unconditionally. And that is one of the things that I've really been able to access and express in my relationship with Boone, is how to love him the way that she loved me. It's not that I did not love my first boyfriend, but I really didn't know how to love until it was shown to me through my relationship with Karine. Because again, the patriarchal way of basically men being raised to not kind of show emotion, to not express emotion, that ends up also carrying over into homosexual relationships, unfortunately. Now, some people are more connected to their female side or their masculine side. But the reality is that we are all kind of pre-programmed and indoctrinated into this way of being. In terms of my sexuality, is that I never felt like I was not a gay man. I never felt like I was not who I was prior to the relationship. I just felt like, well, maybe I'm bisexual because I can function sexually with both men and women. I definitely feel like I'm definitely more identifying more as a gay man than as heterosexual or as bisexual. And oftentimes people will ask me, well, what's the secret to the success of your marriage? And I say, it's very simple to me. Renewed respect and admiration daily.
It's like your marriage, your relationship with him is a live organism.
It is. It really is. I've never thought about it in that way, but it is.
I look forward to that book, which will inspire the movie.
Yes. No, absolutely.
Thank you for sharing that part of yourself. It's inspirational, truly. If it's okay to ask maybe just a few questions about your career, which is just as dynamic. First of all, you're an actor, dancer, choreographer, singer. Which came first?
Singing.
Okay.
I grew up in a boy choir. I joined the choir at 11 years old with somebody else that I know your audience will really recognize, with Lenny Kravitz. Okay. And we basically grew up together. And this boy choir was one of the most renowned boy choirs in the world, but in the country, the premier boy choir. It's called the California Boys Choir. And if you read his book, Lenny's memoir, he talks extensively about our experience in the choir and the impact that made on both of us in terms of our artistic careers. But that was what started it. I started singing. It wasn't until I actually had to lose weight that I started dancing, because I had an acting teacher of mine in high school called me into his office and said, Phineas, you know, you're really good, but you're not going to really have a career until you're in your 30s because of your type. You look more of like a character actor. Fell in love with dance, and I loved dancing a lot more than I loved any kind of other physical exercise. And that's what I basically used to lose weight.
And how old were you?
I was 16 when I started dancing.
Okay.
I was 16 when I started dancing, and I was 18 when I got a chorus line. my first Broadway production contract.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was actually in high school at the time. I was a senior in high school, and I cut school to go to this open audition because there was a woman who came to our drama class, our musical theater class, who was actually in the production of A Chorus Line, who was an alumni of Beverly. I went to Beverly Hills High School. And she was an alumni, and she says, if anybody's really serious about actually having a career in the stage, I really encourage you to go to this open audition for A Chorus Line. I made it through the first cut, and then made it through the second cut, made it through the third cut, and was offered the job at the end of the day. And I was just like, okay, but I'm still in high school. Can I graduate first? And they said, oh, yeah, no, this contract won't be until like, you know, until the summer. So you'll already finish school. And I got a call a couple of weeks later saying, oh, no, the schedule is changing. We're going to actually start in 2 weeks. We're going to need you to be in rehearsals from 10 o'clock to 6 o'clock. You can finish school and we'll just put you on the list of who we can hire in the future. And I said, no, I'll figure out how to make this work. So I basically was taking my finals every morning from 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock, then rushing to the theater to rehearse and learn the show from 10 o'clock to 6 o'clock, and ended up starting my career. And I ended up graduating, but ended up not graduating with my class in the ceremony because I was actually already performing.
Booked and ready.
booked and ready. But again, it was a situation where I was so ready, Eric. I had been given mentors who taught me how to audition, who taught us how to be prepared, who taught us how to walk into a room, who taught us how to get a job. That started it. And from there, I never stopped working. The reason why I started teaching dance, though, was because as an artist, you've got to have multiple streams of income. You're never going to be able to survive off of one gig. And that was such a great decision for me because it allowed me to still express my creativity, but it allowed me to have the flexibility to, if I got a job, I could stop teaching. It was no problem. Once I got a job, it actually increased my reputation as a teacher, and more students would come because I was a working performer, singer, dancer, or actor, and they would come to my class. One of my biggest mentors, who is Hinton Battle. And Hinton Battle, for the audience that doesn't know Broadway, is a legendary icon. He's won 3 Tony Awards. He was one of the first African-American ballet dancers that was actually seen on a ballet stage. Just tremendous technique, tremendous charisma, tremendous singing voice. And when I was actually in my last year of high school, they were doing Sophisticated Ladies at the Schubert Theater, which is right around the corner from the high school. And my cousin was an usher at the theater. Every single night, he would sneak me into the show and I'd watch them perform. Gregory Hines, Hinton Battle, Greg Burge, playing these amazing roles. And literally show up at the stage door after every performance and be that obnoxious fan and say, what do I do to look like you? And how do I get the flexibility? He says, oh, fall asleep with your legs in second on the wall, with your legs in splits on the wall. It'll slowly go down and get better. Well, the first night I did that, I couldn't stand the next day. I couldn't even close my legs. But I was destined to be able to kick my head, to be able to have splits in all directions like Hinton. It's very interesting because Hinton was actually the person who started my dance teaching career, because when I was after doing Cats, I'd done Cats for like 2 years, 1 year too long. What ended up happening was that I ended up having really bad chronic back issues. And when I left the show, I thought I'd never dance again. And Hinton says, you know what, Phineas, come to take my class. I'll get you back in shape. You'll be fine. I was a pretty accomplished dancer. But I was still intimidated to be in his class. But I was like, okay, I'll take my mentor's class. He got a TV movie and needed to leave for 2 weeks and said, I asked the owner of the studio for you to sub for me and take my class and to sub my classes when I'm gone for the 2 weeks. And I says, Hinton, I've never taught dance before. He says, you know, you'll be fine. So in that 2 weeks of him being gone, 2 women from Germany had come to LA to recruit a dance teacher to go to their studio in Munich for 6 weeks. And during this time, I was also up for two major TV series, network TV series. One was to play Dwayne Wayne in A Different World, and the other one was to replace Rerun on What's Happening Now. And I knew I was going to get one of these two. I just knew it. So every time these two teachers would come into class and try to recruit me to go to Germany, I would say no. And they would offer more money because I just knew that I was going to get one of these two TV series. Well, I got my call from my agent on the same day that I did not book either of them. And they came back with their final offer, which was a lot of money. And I said, okay, I'll come for 6 weeks. I went to Germany for 6 weeks, used it as the foundation of me stepping into my own identity as a dance teacher, and stayed for 9 months, and then went from Munich to Paris and stayed in Paris for 2.5 years, which is where I met my former wife. At that point, I was getting a reputation as being a dance teacher around the world. And went from Paris to went to Sweden, was in Sweden for like 3 months, from Sweden to Japan, would be in Japan for like 2 to 3 months at a time for like 3 different years. And basically established myself as a dancer, as a dance teacher and a choreographer, started choreographing for artists.
What I hear is, in one way or another, your channels have always been open. Creatively and personally, where do you think that comes from?
Your biggest advantage and your biggest disadvantage are within you. When you walk into a room with just an ounce of doubt, and somebody's walking into the room with no doubt at all, it's unconscious what the people behind the desk feel. Because my dad was a successful musician and a famous musician, I never thought that it was not possible for me to be an artist. And I really believe that me being open and being available and looking at avenues of how to achieve what I knew I wanted to achieve, because when I was 5 years old, I already knew I wanted to be on Broadway. My parents took me to see Oliver in the movie theater. And after the movie, I said, I want to be one of those kids. I want to be up on stage. I want to be in the movies dancing and singing like that. That was all I thought about from then on. Also, Lenny's mom, Roxy Roker, who was Helen Willis on the Jeffersons, gave us very good sound advice when we were young. You know, she said, you're going to always have a door that's going to always be open to you. You're going to always have something that's going to allow you to get into the room. But it's you being an expert at your craft that's going to keep you in the room. Focus on really mastering your craft, whether it's your dancing, whether it's your acting, whether it's your singing, master it. Be a master of everything that you're doing, and you will be able to stay in the room. One of my mentors in the boy choir said, find somebody who has what you want and do what they do. I would just literally follow and do exactly what they would do. When I got Cats, I started really investing time and energy in my acting. And I joined an acting school called the Playhouse West, which is a Meisner technique acting school. Meisner is one of the main acting techniques that came out of Stanislavski's technique. I'd already done break-in, but I had enough acting experience from high school to know how to basically get through that. But I knew I wanted to do more.
And mentioning break-in, when did that come in?
I was cast in break-in after I had done a Chorus Line. And after that, I came back to LA and was cast in Break-In. After Break-In, I did Cats. And then after Cats, I started teaching and started choreographing. And then came back to theater in Ragtime. And then did Aida.
So with the movie Break-In, because so many people know the film, what was it like working with that production, with that project?
That was very interesting because when I first was introduced to the writers months prior to when I even auditioned, and I actually took the writers to a club in Los Angeles that Ice-T was the DJ. after seeing Ice-T, Phineas, can you please go and give him our card because we want to actually have him in the movie that we're writing. And then when they had the audition, they said, well, there's a part in the movie that would maybe be right for you, but we're not really sure. And when the auditions came around, I auditioned as a dancer and then was called in as an actor to audition for the role of Adam. Adam was only like three sentences in the original script of the movie. I knew that they really weren't going to be able to get a clear idea of who Adam was by just those three sentences. So I said, if you don't mind, I would like to just improvise and just show you who he is. Went into the audition, had a comb and started teasing the director's hair and started basically being very flamboyant in how I was presenting myself. And then I got the role. Between me getting the role and actually really going into the major film production of the movie, they fired that director. They fired him because a lot of the characters were starting to become too stereotypical. So they fired him and they hired a director who was an Israeli guy who didn't even speak English.
And he directed the film.
But he didn't have to, because basically from then on there, we could basically do what we wanted to do. So I was able to tone down a lot of the stereotypical stuff that I was doing in the very beginning and make it more just nuanced. My character never says he's gay. You just know it by basically his behavior. The more I was actually working on the film, the bigger my role got, because I became one of the comedic sidekicks. And I was actually the most integral part in bringing the urban world into the professional dance world. For an urban world to embrace a gay character, a gay friend, was huge at that time. Looking back at it now, it's really revolutionary in terms of just being a part of a movie and expressing an LGBT character, LGBTQ plus character in a movie that was going to portray us in a very positive light. And from there, 40 years later, the movie has become this cult classic. And it has inspired and motivated people like G to embrace who they are because of my character. And that was just something I never thought was even possible. As a matter of fact, when I was actually cast in the movie, I did my very, very best to not be pigeonholed into gay characters and did not want anybody to know that I was gay.
You mentioned the stereotypes, and what the first thing that I thought of from the film is that you're natural in it.
Yeah. Well, it was very interesting because I say when I was first cast, it was basically stereotypes. Like even when I went in and started teasing his hair, I went way over the top and they loved it, of course. But then when I didn't have somebody telling me what to do or how to say the line, I was like, let me just do this the way that I want to do this and make it a little bit less obvious. And one of my other mentors, Billy Goodson, he was inspiration for a lot of my fashion choices in the movie. Because again, a lot of our clothes were our clothes. And so you'll see a lot of bandanas tied around my ankle, around my leg warmers. You'll see the studs, you know, the belts. All of those things were all inspired by him.
Looking back, how much of Phineas was Adam?
Well, I mean, obviously I was a dancer. I was gay. I was not flamboyant in terms of how I expressed myself. I did not dress in little pink shorts on the street. That was not me. There were people who I knew who would do that. And so I basically allowed my experience of knowing those people to influence the character. I got a review in Daily Variety, and they say something like, he puts across the character's gayness in a very unspoken manner. And I was like, that's exactly right. That's exactly what I wanted.
Which do you prefer, the liveness of theater or film and television?
I love the liveness of theater because you have an opportunity to express the line or the movement or the song differently every night. Obviously, certain things are set. The audience is always different. So the audience's reactions are always different. So that adds a different dimension in terms of how the performance is actually expressed real time. But that's the part that makes live theater, the live experience, so magical.
You've lived a life professionally and personally that a lot of people, I feel like survivor is such a small word for the things that you've gone through, because to me it's bigger than that, because you've excelled because of that in some ways, it seems like. What would you say is next for you?
Well, what's next for me? And this is an interesting question, because I really, like I said, try to stay present. I really find my most joy and my most serenity, my most peace, not thinking too far into the future. People have this false sense of security that we're going to be here tomorrow. I really try to choose to not think too far into the future. I just want to actually continue to thread my days as good days, happy days, days where I can express and receive love. And wherever that leads me, that leads me. I had a lot of ambition when I was younger. I wanted to be on Broadway. I wanted to do TV. I wanted to be on the Academy Awards. I wanted to choreograph. I wanted to all these things. I was able to do them. But when I went through my health crisis, something came to me in terms of just wondering, what is it really worth? I realized that by projecting more accomplishments, by projecting more ambition into what things I want to do in the future, I'm not really allowing myself to own this present moment, really embrace and love this present moment. I mean, I enjoyed the journey of mastering my crafts in many different ways and being able to actually inspire and motivate others to master their craft. But at this point in time, Eric, I really have a problem promoting ambition and achievements. We attach ourselves too much with those goals, we're going to suffer. And I've suffered enough. I just want to be open to knowing that whatever is next is going to benefit me and it's going to benefit humanity in some greater way.
I relate to that where I'm at in my life. I didn't plan any of these, most of what's happened these last 4 years, because I've had people say, well, what's going to happen 6 months from now? Especially coming from a life I had where it was very regimented as far as a 9-to-5 living. And I'm like, honestly, I don't know. That wasn't how it started.
Right. And that just so you know, Eric, that's a beautiful place to be in. It's hard for people to understand, because we're socially taught to plan for the future and to have certain things in order so that our future can be without turmoil or crisis. Well, we're looking for safety. But the reality is, like I said, it's all a false sense of security. If we really truly believe that we know that we're going to be here next week, next month, next year, we really don't.
Will you ever regenerate your YouTube channel?
Yes, eventually. That's something also, because again, I'm just looking at all my options. I'm looking at ways in terms of how to create content, meaningful content, with the new tools that are at our disposal today.
Well, I want to say thank you very much. This has been really, really great, as I knew it would. I always end by asking, do you have any final thoughts or insights?
Love is the most important thing to receive and to express. And if you can find a way to do that daily, you will find joy. You will find happiness. And that is expressing it through the knowledge that I choose to share with others and inspire and motivate hopefully somebody out there to see something differently or look at life through a different lens. Understand and embrace the moment that you are in. Understand and embrace that what you may think is your biggest challenge and biggest crisis can also end up being your greatest reward and your greatest gift. And if you can find joy in the deepest, darkest places of your experience, then you have found, I believe, one of the major reasons why we're here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Where can we engage with you online?
I am on Instagram at Phineas Newborn. You can find me on my YouTube channel, Phineas Newborn III.
Thank you for spending time with us. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, comment, and subscribe. Share with your friends too. You can also follow us on Instagram at Our Black Gay Diaspora and on Twitter at BLK Gay Diaspora. Until next time.